WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am very excited indeed that we can begin today's morning show, begin this week of morning shows, with a very special guest that joins us in the studio. His name is John Happ, and he is the author of an absolutely fascinating and inspiring new book called The Navigation Case: Training, Flying, and Fighting, the 1942 to 1945 New Guinea War. This is a largely forgotten chapter from World War II, and it seems as though for all that has been written about that long and terrible conflict, that there continue to be fascinating stories that come to light. And such is the case with this book and John Happ's story of his father, Len, who was a pilot during World War II, and a pilot who worked in two very different ways, as a combat pilot in the Pacific Theater, and then also as a pilot who evacuated and transported medical patients. And both of those experiences, very, very powerful, of deep impact to him personally, and very little of this was ever talked about in the Happ household as my guest John Happ was growing up. And we will find out about the way in which a couple of years after his father's death, he came to understand just at least some of what his father had experienced during the Second World War. John Happ has been invited by the History Department at Carthage College to give a presentation on the Carthage campus this Wednesday, November 3rd at 5 p.m. And the public is very warmly welcome to come and attend this talk. But we have John Happ in our studios to talk about his new book, which is published by Knox Press, again titled The Navigation Case: Training, Flying, and Fighting, the 1942 to 1945 New Guinea War. John Happ is a contributing editor to the Journal of the American Revolution. John Happ, we welcome you to the morning show.
Good morning, Greg. It's great to be here. Thanks for the opportunity.
This is very, very exciting. I'm so glad we can have this conversation. And I know the history faculty at Carthage is so excited to be able to resurrect its speaker series after a period of hiatus because of the COVID pandemic.
Right.
And so this is an exciting way for them to get that underway again. Let's begin with the story of how you came across this chapter from your own father's life that you knew very, very little about. This is back roughly around 1990 or so, a couple of years after your father had passed away. You take it from there.
Yeah, so my father spoke very little about his time in the war. I remember asking him, what did you do in the war? And he would simply say that I was a pilot in New Guinea. And you have to understand a couple of things. First of all, my father was a profoundly mild-mannered guy, a church-going man, a gardener. And so if he were to say he were a pilot in the war, I assumed that he meant transport, hauling men and goods around here and there, bringing beans to the front line kind of thing. I never I never thought otherwise. The other thing is, this was the 1960s and 70s when I grew up, the Vietnam era. It was not very popular to be military in those days, and so kids were questioning what the parents were doing, what America was doing, and so I can understand, you know, another motivation for him to be reserved about what he did. But as I began to go through the contents of this crusty leather briefcase that I inherited, I came to learn that he was a combat pilot. And that was very, very moving for me after having grown up watching scenes of our men and some women in green fatigues marching through the dense jungles of Vietnam. We didn't even know where Vietnam was. And so to think and come to learn the fact that my father flew 64, in fact, violent and deadly combat missions, it was sobering for me to learn that, I have to say.
Let's talk a little bit about this case, and I should mention that you have brought it along with you, this, as you characterize it, mysterious, crusty leather case that was found in the attic as your parents' home was being cleaned out, and
right.
On the cover, the words embossed, Navigation Dead Reckoning.
Yes.
I don't really understand what those words mean, Navigation Dead Reckoning. Is that military terminology of some kind?
Dead Reckoning is kind of like flying based on what you can observe. You're watching the landmarks. And in their case, in New Guinea, they came to know river valleys and mountains, and then to the north and northwest of them was the sea, the Bismarck Sea. And so they're flying based, they're trained to fly on instruments, but they're also obviously getting to know the contours of the land beneath them and flying, dead reckoning as the crow flies, so to speak.
Interesting. So this is the kind of leather case that a pilot would have had with them quite a lot of the time?
Sure. As they move from base to base, they're collecting, maps and documents and training manuals. My father flew something upwards of 11 different airplanes through this dramatic growth in the aviation industry. If you don't mind me saying, in 1938, aviation was not even a blip in America's GDP figures. By 1945, it's the leading contributor in the largest economy on planet Earth. And in that time, my father started with a single-engine airplane that would weigh about 150 pounds to a 15,000-pound empty twin-engine combat fighter plane, which is the A-20. But in between, he learned to fly 10 other types of airplanes with different technical quirks that he had to learn, not the least of which was landing gear or not landing gear, fixed landing gear or retractable landing gear. And then on the panel of the cockpit, he would, the airplanes went from 3 or 4 dials to 5, 6, 7, 8 dials, all these things he's paying attention to. And then he's got to carry out a mission, dropping bombs and strafing and, fighting the war kind of thing. So it's mind-boggling to me to imagine what pilots had to maintain in their heads in order to survive, carry out their missions, get back, and land safely.
Mm-hmm. It really helps us understand why the observation was made at some point that the typical pilot was worn down by their action more quickly than, for instance, the typical troop on the soldier on the ground.
It's another thing that I never knew. Hmm. My father crossed the Pacific Ocean with about 1,100 other guys, and the boat, of course, was loaded with supplies and equipment. But I never knew, really, that, as they say, medics came to find out that pilots simply wore out faster than enlisted men. And the reason I'm simply mentioning that he came across the Pacific with those 1,100 other men is that the far majority of them stayed on through the war months after my father was rotated off the front lines. These are mechanics, foot soldiers, the army troops, but basically the crew members that worked on the airplanes and kept them operational, they stayed on the front lines for months after the pilots were rotated out, simply because the stress and the difficulties that the pilots faced just wore them down. And to keep them flying risks not only their lives, but at the time risked the almost irreplaceable airplanes that they were flying with.
Mm. So back to the leather case, you come across this, you see what is embossed on the outside of it, and you find inside of it a mass of materials, all kinds of different things. Just give us an idea of what sorts of documents were housed in this case that you'd basically never laid eyes on before.
Never laid eyes on it before in my life. I never knew it existed until my mother presented it to me. Inside were military orders, organized collection of photos, and correspondence, basically, along with a couple other souvenirs. Like, he would send my mom, I don't know if people remember what swizzle sticks are, but he would set up, he'd be at a bar or something having a drink after his mission, and the bar had swizzle sticks, with the hotel name embossed on it. And anyway, those kinds of souvenirs. But basically, I put these materials into three stacks: the military orders, the photographs, and the correspondence. And from there, set about trying to organize that in chronological order, according to the public histories of the war, and so that I could understand the context of what was happening and what my father was doing in New Guinea, of all places.
Right.
I never understood what he was doing in New Guinea. If we were fighting the Japanese, what did New Guinea have to do with it? I'd never heard of New Guinea and couldn't find it on a map.
One of the things you describe in your book is how, amongst all of these other documents and so on, was an article about New Guinea and about a massive typhoon, caused, in the words of this article, horror and tragedy.
So that was the tipping point. I had always been interested in our own family history, my mother's side of the family, my father's side of the family. And when this article tumbled out describing, this massive typhoon that caused, death and destruction, the largest non-combat loss of men and equipment in the history of the U.S. Air Force, my interest was piqued. But I can tell you again, I assumed my father was flying a transport airplane at that time and got caught in some big, weather storm. The truth is unimaginably different. I hope I did a good job of documenting it, because it's the event is found nowhere else in history outside of this group's own personal records. And my father, many years later, documented it himself in correspondence to an Australian Foreign Service officer by the name of Michael Claringbold, who got to know the men of that bomb group because he was searching for downed aircraft to clean up and polish up and restore for museums in Australia. So he was out looking for the men's story. And in that context, my father wrote him all sorts of episodes of what happened and revealed never-before-recorded missions, not recorded by General MacArthur's biographers, not recorded by the MacArthur Foundation in Norfolk, Virginia, absolutely unknown to history. And they are monumental, important events in the conduct, of the overall war.
And we should mention that Michael Claringbold, that you just mentioned, wrote a book ultimately called Black Sunday. And Black Sunday is the term by which this terrible day is known, in which this storm comes in and creates such terrible havoc and
destruction. But it's absolutely unknown outside that bomb group. Right. It's not referred to anywhere else.
Hmm. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with John Happ, who is the author of a book, a brand new book just published, called The Navigation Case: Training, Flying, and Fighting, the 1942 to 1945 New Guinea War. This is a chapter of the Second World War, our activity in the Pacific Theater that, as John Happ was just saying, was to a large extent unknown to the rest of the world. And it's a fascinating story that he tells in painstaking detail in his new book. One of the things that I really appreciate about your book is the rich context in which you sort of present this story. And of course, one of the most important things for us to understand is what was going on in the Pacific Theater in the first years of the Second World War, when the United States had adopted a policy of Germany first. That is, our resources would primarily be devoted to defeating Hitler, to defeating Germany and the Axis powers. And that meant then for the Pacific Theater, where we had still another formidable enemy, that facet of the war had to be carried out in sort of very different fashion. Help our listeners understand what was going on in the Pacific Theater and sort of the rather kind of defensive strategy that had to be adopted by General MacArthur and other leaders.
Right. So we have to remember that America wanted nothing to do with that war in Europe. They wanted Europeans to fight it out for themselves. But we got dragged into the war relatively unprepared because of Pearl Harbor. The Japanese surprise attack on Pearl Harbor launched us into the war. But now we're in war fighting on two fronts, both in Europe and in the Pacific. The Allied heads of states, Stalin, Churchill, Roosevelt, for example, got together. They had various meetings, and they decided that the best way for America to participate in the war was by joining the European allies first, defeating Germany first, and then those, because they feared Germany. If Germany had overrun the Allies without America's intervention, it was understood that Germany would be much, much harder to defeat. So they decided they would concentrate their forces against Germany first and then turn to the Pacific Theater after Germany was dealt with. Well, that translated almost literally into the fact that 85% of America's personnel and war materiel, all of our bombs, guns, bullets, bread and butter, would go to Europe to fight the Nazis, leaving a scant 15% for the Pacific Theater. And so a very, very dramatic point is made that over the first 18 months of the war, fighting these defensive battles, which is what Japan wanted America to be fighting these atrocious battles of attrition because they wanted to negotiate a settlement. They have just reconquered all of these former European colonies, Hong Kong, Singapore. The Dutch East Indies was the name of what is today Indonesia. So Japan had taken over these colonies, and they were hoping that America would negotiate a settlement and allow Japan to keep some of these colonies. So the Germany First policy played right into Japan's hands, but made it impossible, almost impossible, for MacArthur to take any offensive action against the Japanese to defend Australia or defend America's supply lines from San Francisco down to Australia, where MacArthur was, you know, then making his base.
That supply line, that's something that's important for us to understand, and that's also something that tends to be kind of mentioned in passing in more kind of exhaustive histories of the overall Second World War, but that is of crucial importance here. At one point you quote former President William McKinley as talking about, in this part of the world, these sort of scattered islands that are like stepping stones and absolutely essential for a supply line to function in kind of a meaningful way. Help us understand just what a challenge it was, first of all, to establish such a supply line and then to somehow defend it against as formidable an opponent as the Japanese.
So if you could imagine a map in your mind from San Francisco down to Hawaii, that's easy enough. And then you have these scattered islands like Fiji or Tahiti or the Solomon Islands and things like that. Those were all valuable stepping stones, as Greg said. They were supply depots. Airplanes could only fly a limited range for the most part. So getting to Hawaii was a challenge in and of itself. They didn't have enough gas. They didn't have enough engine power to get beyond that. So you would fly to Hawaii and refuel. You would fly to Fiji and refuel. You would fly to the Solomon Islands and refuel and eventually make your way down to Australia. And the same was true with boats. Boats would haul coal, deposit it in Fiji so that the boat behind them could refuel, sort of thing. And so it's this little, it's broken down into segments, literally like a chain, one link connected to another, in order to get goods in place for MacArthur to use them, you know, to defend not only the previous link in the supply chain, but eventually defend Australia as well.
One of the things you mentioned, speaking of defending Australia, is that Australians, by and large, were terrified by the threat that Japan posed. And with so many others falling into Japanese hands, the Australians justifiably felt like they were next. And you tell us that there was actually something of a plan in place that Australia would, in effect, yield the northern part of Australia to the Japanese and concentrate their efforts on trying to defend the southern part of Australia, where the population was denser. It's just hard to imagine anything more frightening than what the Australians were facing at that point.
Well, this is how colonialism works as well. Australia had a formidable male population, but where were they? They were in the Middle East, at the behest of the imperial authorities in Britain, fighting Britain's war in the Middle East. So their men weren't even home to defend the country. So yes, the Australians were shocked by the rapid progress south that the Japanese were making through Hawaii and then the Philippines, down the entire coast of China, Singapore, Hong Kong, and then the Dutch East Indies, as I said. So they saw this web of Japanese, you know, mischief and combat and firepower descending towards them. So they had internally planned to secede the northern half of the country to the Japanese and defend, forcibly defending a line that runs from east to west across the country at the town of Brisbane. And that was called the Brisbane Line. MacArthur had been chased out of the Philippines at about the same time the Japanese were attacking Hawaii. They overran the Philippines where MacArthur was working, trying to build up the Philippine Army defense forces. He's chased out of the Philippines, and shortly after he arrives in Australia, he learns that their plan is this plan called the Brisbane Line, to secede half of the country to the Japanese. His biographies say that he turned white and his knees buckled when he learned about that.
Mm. And, of course, ultimately MacArthur decides to redraw the line of defense. Mm. And ultimately, one of the most crucial points in his strategy in the Pacific Theater involves this Australian-held colony of New Guinea, which you describe it as in this point in time a still very much uncharted and unknown land, an unexplored paradise. Tell us more about New Guinea and why it was such a crucial factor in all of this.
New Guinea remains today one of the most primitive spots on planet Earth. And in the 1940s, it was barely explored. You have to dig into some real obscure diaries of travelers from those days to learn that even up until 1940, explorers had only been poking around the edges. The waters were not charted. The mountains were not charted. We didn't know the altitudes of the mountain in many instances. And my father, even as late as 1943 and 1944, flew with emergency maps in case he was shot down, emergency maps, which with large portions of the map marked unexplored, unknown territory.
Wow.
Mind-boggling to imagine, you know, we know the modern Air Force today to be so incredibly strong and formidable. But in those days, you know, the maps that they gave their pilots for survival were marked unknown territory, unexplored, vast swaths of the land. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, New Guinea lies along the supply chain that MacArthur was trying to defend, and he chooses a chain of mountains that runs from the southeast to the northwest of the island of New Guinea, which is larger than France and Britain, by the way, 1,500 miles from end to end, and that's where he chose to try to defend Australia, to defend his supply lines along that mountain ridge.
And this is in 1943, and by this point, if I understand correctly, America was finally in a position to divert a bit more manpower and resources to this specific theater?
Right. So in the summer of 1942, MacArthur finally gets a general who's in charge of the U.S. Army Air Corps. His name is General Kenney. But at the time, he was given only 260 airplanes with which to work, fill out his 5th Air Force. And many of those airplanes, quote unquote, were unserviceable. The planes were shipped to Australia in pieces to be assembled in Australia, and many of the parts went missing. They had to jerry-rig various parts to try and make those airplanes that he was sent, that raw 15% of firepower that we could afford to send to the Pacific, almost all unusable. So, yeah, that was the summer of 42, just pathetic. One of the dramatic points that I make is that, you know, this is the greatest it ends up as the greatest campaign victory in the history of the U.S. Air Force. But in the summer of 42, the jungle is so dense. There's a battle called the Battle of the Kokoda Trail. The jungle is so dense that the troops are moving along one-man footpaths to get from one place to another. And the generals are hoping to put together these massive, sweeping ground attacks as though they were in, you know, the Great Plains, you know, of France or in Germany or the north coast of Africa. But it just wasn't possible. And so they decide, we know what we'll do now. We'll airlift a bunch of troops and supplies into that battle and overrun the Japanese. Well, they have to abort the entire plan because they don't have enough airplanes. They have a few airplanes that can carry, you know, 1,000, you know, 20 guys at a time. And so it would have taken them thousands of trips just to drop, you know, troops and supplies in. It was aborted because they did not have the airplanes to carry out the mission.
Mm. Well, eventually they do have enough planes and other resources in order for MacArthur to carry out what I think at one point in the book you call MacArthur's triple play.
Yes.
And it involves what ultimately is a great surprise against the Japanese. In some ways, this is a reversal of what happened on Pearl Harbor when we are able to surprise the Japanese by, in effect, if I understand correctly, bypassing several more likely targets in favor of actually trying to take out something called Hollandia.
Hollandia, yeah. So MacArthur while he's trying to build his supply chain, finally is in a position to start to break apart the supply chain serving the Japanese, feeding the Japanese. So in the fall of 1943, 18 months, 20 months after Pearl Harbor, General Kenney finally receives approximately 3,300 aircraft and pilots and crew to operate these. And MacArthur's coming to realize that he can't conduct these sweeping ground troop movements. Yes, there are tanks. Yes, there are is artillery. But it is sluggishly slow trying to move forward, trying to move the battle lines. So MacArthur and Kenney decide, we can try and break the Japanese supply line by massive air power. And they finally have the air power to do it. So MacArthur creates a diversion to attack one of these supply depots in the supply chain by using ground troops. He's faking the Japanese into believing that he's setting up a traditional ground war against a town called Madang. The long and the short of it is the Japanese move troops down from this further base called Hollandia that American intelligence had informed MacArthur was a massive supply center. And so MacArthur had been testing, General Kenney had been testing the men's endurance, the pilot's endurance, and the airplane's endurance, two-hour one-way flights out to attack these various supply depots and bases, 2 hours back. Can the airplane handle it? Can the men handle it? MacArthur decides that they can. The Japanese move more and more equipment down to confront the Americans at Madang, thinking that this traditional ground battle is about to take place. And on April 16th, on a day of horrendous weather, MacArthur orders a massive blow to attack Hollandia, which the Japanese believed to be out of range of U.S. bombers.
Mm-hmm. You tell us that those planes poised for takeoff, in fact, sat on the ground for hours while the leaders tried to decide whether or not it made sense to go ahead because of this threatening weather. And ultimately, the decision was made to go ahead, and finally these planes could take off.
Right. My father at this point was an operations officer as well as a flight leader and, A-20 pilot. And so he has access to weather reports, intelligence about the Japanese, and they knew that the weather conditions to get to that target were marginal at best. He also knew that they were going to fly their A-20s at the very limits of their capacity for gas consumption. And so when MacArthur orders this airstrike, the men knew, my father knew, that the conditions were marginal. New Guinea sits just below the equator, and the weather, and it rains, 3 days out of four, torrential downpours. So the men knew that the weather was marginal to begin with, and MacArthur's reassessing the mission as the men are sitting in their cockpits with the cockpit rattling and the wings wavering back and forth in this bad weather. Finally, the men are given the go to take off, and off they go, over 300 aircrafts from multiple allied bases are sent to attack this distant, two and a half hour distant Japanese base called Hollandia.
You describe this in remarkable detail, and it ultimately is assessed to be the greatest campaign in the history of the U.S. Air Force. I mean, and perhaps the most emphatic victory by the U.S. Air Force in our country's history. At one point, you describe it as the most successful demonstration of air power in our country's history. But it also ends up being a terribly dark day because of the massive casualties that are suffered because of this terrible typhoon. Describe this massive storm and its impact.
So the men finally take off, 300 strong airplanes, each with gunners and crew members on in their airplanes. 2 hours out, the mission is declared a success by MacArthur's headquarters. They completely surprise the Japanese. The Japanese scatter into the jungle. 300 airplanes are destroyed. Japanese airplanes are destroyed on the runway before they had any chance to get off the ground and counterattack the Americans. But as the men were engaged in their bombing runs and activity, a massive storm builds behind them, north to south across the entire island of New Guinea. Mountains ignite with steam and heat. Clouds barrel down into the river valleys. The storm rages over the sea. The sea is whipped up into white caps. The men are blocked from going home. Diaries of mission survivors talk about walls of weather. They talk about men being lost, just simply disappearing into the mountains and into the jungle, some lost into the sea. 37 aircraft, in fact, are lost with their gunners and pilots, resulting in the largest non-combat loss of men and equipment in the history of the Air Force.
Black Sunday, it's called, and 37 aircraft ultimately and the men aboard are lost in this terrible incident, and you describe it in detail. And again, it's incredible that until now we know so little about this. Can you explain why this is such an obscure moment in the Second World War?
My father used almost those exact words 40 years later when he was corresponding with that Australian Foreign Service agent. He couldn't understand why this was, you know, not more known or not more talked about. I imagine that, number one, the majority of the histories of the Pacific War are written by Navy people. The Air Force was simply a branch of the U.S. Army. Respectfully so. That's great. It was a small service, just growing. It was not until 1947 that the Air Force became its own branch, its own service branch. And so the histories and the documentation are all focused on the naval battles and on the ground war. And I understand that. I get that. But and then secondly, you know, this was, you know, 15% of America's attention. The attention was naturally focused on the Nazis and all their evil in Europe, rightfully so. And then the massive D-Day operation. So I can't really explain why. There are plenty of MacArthur biographies. This triple play, which is a remarkable operation, is found nowhere in the history, nowhere in any of MacArthur's biographies. The Americans, the Allies, go on to dominate the entire length, the 1,500-mile length of Australia, from the Coral Sea in the southeast to the Halmahera Sea in the northwest. It's the first ever demonstration of air superiority over an enemy, and that is now the widely gold standard, you know, objective in any war, is to secure air superiority over your enemy. And General Kenny and MacArthur did it for the first time in the history of the U.S. Air Force, in the history of, in America's history, leading to, as I say, and it's now being accepted as the greatest campaign victory in the history of the United States.
Mm. We're speaking with John Happ, author of The Navigation Case, Training, Flying, and Fighting, the 1942 to 1945 New Guinea War. And there is much more information packed into this fascinating book about all of this. We should say that beyond this is a second story about your father, who ultimately is redeployed, or I think redistributed.
That's
is,
the word
is
they
actually
use, yeah.
The term, where he is taken out of the Pacific Theater, perhaps to his consternation, because he seems ready and willing to engage in still more combat, but instead he is redistributed back to the United States and given a new assignment as a medical air evacuation transport.
Yeah.
And this proves to be actually nearly as remarkable a chapter of the story. Explain to our listeners what your father was doing and the massive amount of miles he was flying as a medical air evacuation transport.
So first of all, I'll say that I'm sure the majority of men and women, when they signed up for their duty, didn't really read all the fine print. They signed up for the duration of the war plus 6 months. And so as a pilot, we might have mentioned that we came to learn that pilots simply wear out faster than enlisted men. However, he signed up for the war plus 6 months. So after he serves his, you know, required number of missions as a pilot on the front lines of battle, he is. He's rotated off the front line and what they call redistributed, sent to a redistribution center in Miami Beach, Florida. He's allowed to cool his heels for a while, but then they decide to reassign him to a base. He was hoping to get to a base closer to where his fiance lived, ultimately my mother, Julia. And so he was. He was reassigned to a medical air evacuation transport base in Stout Field in Indianapolis. At the time, the Battle of the Bulge was raging, and field hospitals were becoming overwhelmed with wounded. Many of those cases were so bad they couldn't really be dealt with in theater in Europe, and so they were medically evacuated out. And my father would pick up various cases of injured soldiers, and he would describe in correspondence to my mother how if a guy thinks he's got it bad, you should just take a look at some of these poor guys. And so he's flying medical evacuation transport missions all over the United States, based alternately based. He barely had a base. He was flying alternately out of Stout Field or Bergstrom Air Base in Texas. But he would pick up people in Baltimore and fly them to Tallahassee, pick them up in Miami Beach, fly them to, you know, Quaddy, Maine. He would fly to Walla Walla, Washington, Ogden, Utah, dropping off these injured soldiers at hospitals closer to their native homes. It's a glorious, beautiful service that the Air Force was providing at the time. We had the luxury because finally our production of airplanes got up sufficiently that we could dedicate airplanes to this fabulous service. However, we don't even know. My father's flying at such a pace and so frequently, all documented only in his correspondence to his fiancée at the time, that he's flying five times more missions, five times faster than he ever did on the front lines of New Guinea.
As a matter of fact, your father at one point is medically grounded because of the just sort of the wear and tear on him mentally and emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
And you tell us in your book that that grounding is reversed.
Wow.
He was supposed to be grounded for what would have been probably a much needed month of break away from what he was doing. A week later, the grounding is reversed. He is back in the air. And ultimately, it sounds like, although I don't think you know all that much about it, but it sounds like ultimately your father kind of collapses from the strain of this.
Absolutely. They use various terms throughout the 1940s to describe what's happening with pilots. Fatigue, nausea, depression, but those are, you know, myriad medical terms people are trying to figure out how to put their finger on what's happening to the pilots. The commanders, however, see this as insubordination, laziness, cowardice, and so there's this battle, constant battle between the medics who recognize that they're not dealing with the same pilot that came in on Monday morning. By Friday, this is a completely different man, so to speak, or woman. But there, my father was an officer, a pilot. He was on that base to fly medical evacuation transport. And so the commanding officer says to the medic and overrules the orders, you know, baloney. You're here as a pilot. Get in the cockpit. We've got bodies to move. Get going. And so having been grounded medically by the doctors, within a week, the doctors are overruled, and he's up in the air, flying from Bergstrom to Boston to Long Island to, Kansas City, back and forth, again, as I said, at a pace five times faster than he was carrying out missions in New Guinea.
Mm. And ultimately, the letters to his girlfriend, eventually your mother, Julia, stop altogether, and it's only weeks later that finally she learns that your father was placed in the hospital.
He's in love. She's in love. He's writing to her every day, not just a postcard, not just one letter, four pages, five pages at a crack. And then every once in a while, we see, it was lovely to speak with you on the telephone last night. So they're communicating on a very, very regular basis. I have stacks of correspondence that my mother saved from my father. After one of these missions are flown to Sedalia, Missouri, of all places, everything stops. Not one word, not one photograph, nothing in the newspaper, nothing in his military records. Weeks go by. My mother has no idea what's happening, what happened. Did he get tired of the relationship? It was a long war. It was a long affair between the two of them. Oceans of ink were spilled over pages, forests of paper, back and forth to my mother's home in Chicago. Had he become, disillusioned and tired and fed up with the relationship? Or did something worse happen? She didn't know. My grandmother, my father's mother, would have no way of knowing. Days pass, weeks pass, no phone calls. The phone is silent in my mother's house in Chicago. And they have no idea what's going on. He's completely lost.
And eventually they learn that, he does finally reach out to them from a hospital. He has been hospitalized. And
3 full weeks later, a letter appears saying, Julia, my dear, I don't know how to tell you what's come over me. I'll explain it to you at some point. I'm sorry I put you all through this, et cetera, et cetera. I expect to be out of this hospital any day now. Well, it was, in fact, not even any day. It was a full week later. And for a total of 3 weeks at Billings General Hospital, without word, without phone call, I've tried many venues to find out what happened at Billings General Hospital, what put him there. The hospital was built for the war, and it was closed shortly after the war, absorbed by a big medical group. I think it might even still exist today, but the records do not. Mm. So we don't know what happened to him. When you look into how they dealt with people with depression or fatigue and things like that, they talk about warm baths and solitude and quiet environments and things like that. My father actually uses some disturbing language, which I don't know how to translate. He said, when I finally get fixed from this operation, I'll be able to tell you everything about it. Did he have an operation? I never saw any scars growing up. I never noticed any unusual behavior. He was a phenomenal father of 6 kids, all college educated. Completely beautiful, normal childhood. Mm. But he talks also about having flying amputated. So he was grounded for good, and it was never overturned. He remained as a ground officer for the duration of the war.
Mm. Well, and as you say, went on to grow up, into adulthood, married, had children, a fine, upstanding gentleman in so many ways, and your life was happy with him. So that's just one more mystery that's part of this story.
It is.
The
yeah.
book, again, is The Navigation Case, Training, Flying, and Fighting, the 1942-45 New Guinea War. And this Wednesday, 5 p.m., in the Campbell Student Union, as part of the Burkhart Lecture Series, you're going to be giving a presentation that people can attend in person if they like, but they need to secure a free ticket ahead of time, or they can watch your presentation via the live stream.